The J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to this, the 300th episode of the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this milestone episode, Sean Carroll and Sam Robson are here to review the final match day of the J1 season. But first, our Yokohama correspondent Stuart Woodward will join us to share his experiences of F. Marinos' big day after they claimed a first top flight title in 15 years. Before a bumper crowd at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday. The J-Talk Podcast starts now. On J-Talk number 300, it's my great pleasure to welcome back our very first ever guest from the pilot episode way back in early 2012. Sean Carroll, how are you?
I'm feeling old when you say it like that, mate. 300 episodes, that's, very, very good going. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yes, it snuck up on me, but it just so happens, it's the last one of the season, and I guess it's timed pretty much to perfection. Joining Sean and myself is our most frequent guest of the past couple of seasons, Sam Robson. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I didn't know I was quite that frequent. The listeners must be getting sick of me by now. But congratulations on the triple century.
Very nice of you, Sam. Thank you very much. And, nobody's getting sick of you. We always love having you on the podcast. And, of course, rounding off our guest list is Cloud9 resident Stuart Woodward, who has kindly taken time out from his celebrations to join us on the pod. Stuart, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's nice to be here. I'm sure I'd have been here anyway, but, I'm very happy to be here.
Terrific, terrific. All right, well, it appeared a near certainty before kickoff, and Yokohama removed any doubt they would claim a fourth J1 championship by scoring twice in the first half and clinically dispatching FC Tokyo 3-0 at the Nissan Stadium. So, Stuart, take us inside your day. How were you feeling before the game? Obviously, all the cards were stacked in Yokohama's favour. Did the fact that you were trying to sort out tickets and seats for about 50 people affect your enjoyment of the day?
It made a lot of work for me that day. So my group is very organised, and so I got everybody to come on time. We in the line at 10 o'clock, but it was absolute chaos at about 9:30, trying to get into the stadium and into the line, and with the rain, the numbers had washed away on the papers that were stuck to the floor. So it was just a whole lot of kind of chaos. And so eventually we just got in there and we ran to our usual area, and which is not in the hottest part of the stadium, but we take the whole row in front of the marathon gate. So we have a glass wall in front of us. And we managed to get two rows of seats there, so it's about 30 people there, and some others a bit further up in the cover for friends who are coming a bit later, some special friends. But I had three guests who don't usually come. One lady, first J League match, first football match probably. We picked up Michael, a tourist who was looking for tickets. So we gave him our last ticket that we'd got spare. And he was very happy and he enjoyed himself and even got a slight portrait in the football article about Jamie's trip in Japan that was published in the Japanese press. Got a sliver of his face at the side there. So I think all of the guests had a very good time, and it was really, really nice when the rain stopped. It was quite cold and wet and miserable in the line, but I didn't feel too cold. Like, there's been other times where I've been, you know, frozen to the bone, but this time I was okay. But of course, you know, once the game kicked off, you know, it was already a little bit of a party atmosphere on our side. The core leader singing some of the older chants that people who'd been there a long time might recognize. And as soon as the first goal went in, that was really just chaos in our section, people falling over and all kinds of scenes of mayhem there. And I'm sure at your side that probably was the first nail in the coffin in that day, because it really was a difficult challenge to take those goals.
Well, yeah, most definitely. So we knew, everything was in Yokohama's favour, and you know they'd earned the right to be 3 points ahead and four goals of goal difference ahead at kickoff. So it was, as I said at the start, a near certainty that they would lift the title at the end of the day. And obviously, Tokyo were without their leading scorer Diego Oliveira, who didn't make it after succumbing to a knee injury in their previous game against Reds. And guys, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on the early exchanges. So Sean, I'll come to you first. Like it seemed to me that you couldn't, as a Tokyo supporter, I couldn't have any complaints about the way that they went about things, especially in the first 15 minutes. They definitely tried to ruffle some F. Marino's feathers. They tried to disrupt the rhythm that Yokohama liked to play with. I mean, the fact that Yokohama didn't score in the first 5 minutes was a victory in itself for Tokyo, obviously, as Yokohama had been getting off to so many fast starts in recent weeks. And basically for Tokyo, an impossible task was, we knew it was impossible to start with, but once Kensuke Nagai missed that chance about 23, 24 minutes in, I guess all Tokyo supporters' hearts would have sunk at that moment. And then, 2 minutes later, Tiraton's deflected strike gave Yokohama the lead, and obviously there was no turning back from then.
Yeah, I think it was the start of the game was a bit strange. It was a bit, like you said, it was Tokyo obviously kind of came out up for it because they had to be, but they seemed, both teams seemed very intent on scrappy stuff, on kicking and fighting and poking, and you know, whether Tokyo were trying to rile up Marinos to get someone sent off, whether it was just the Tokyo players perhaps knowing they had an impossible task and you know they just wanted to ruffle a few feathers against a team that were about to be declared champions ahead of them. I'm not sure, but it was a slightly weird start to the game. I kind of thought Tokyo would go for it and, you know, try to score early. They had to score, I thought, in the first 10 or 15 minutes to have any chance whatsoever of putting off the impossible. And they seemed more intent on ruffling feathers and winding people up and whatever than they did on actually trying to attack. They seem to have changed formation a little as well and almost went 4-2-3-1, which they, to my knowledge, they haven't really played all season. So, you know, if it had worked, maybe you could say it was a tactical masterstroke by Hasegawa to try something different to catch them out. But yeah, I watching it sort of as a, I guess as a neutral, you could say from the sides, it was a slightly weird start, but yeah, there were a couple of sort of half chances and one very good chance, as you say, for Nagai that wasn't taken. And once the game then did settle down, sort of, you know, halfway through the first half, it did look like, yeah, you know, there was no way Tokyo were going to have enough to get the goals and the win they needed. And they obviously, yeah, they were served a huge slice of bad luck with the deflected goal that put them 1-0 behind. And once that happened, you know, everybody in the stadium, including those on the pitch, knew that the game was up.
Indeed. And, Sam, I don't know if you want to share any of your thoughts about the opening exchanges. I mean, yeah, to me it was the first 15 minutes or so were pretty scrappy, as Sean and I have said. Then Yokohama appeared to have a good five minutes or so of decent pressure. And then that Nagai chance came seemingly out of nowhere. And that was obviously it for Tokyo once that didn't go in. And then, Tirithon's deflected strike.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what's been said. I think Tokyo sort of set up, I think the only time I can remember it being similar was against Kobe, when I think Nagai on that day was on the bench, so Takahashi played up more or less alongside Diego Oliveira. So I think they tried to get him in the game. It was him that played the ball through to Nagai for one of his chances. But yeah, there wasn't really the quality. There was a lot of intensity, a lot of pressure. You were pressing quite highly, but it was kind of fairly easy for Marinos to kind of come through that period. There wasn't the quality as there was in that Kobe game, and probably Marinos defended a lot better than Kobe did on that day. They weren't forced into the errors quite as much as Kobe were. And yeah, I mean, that goal was a killer as well. I mean, you needed everything to go your way, and to get that sort of slice of misfortune go against you, I think that kind of drained everything out of Tokyo. But yeah, I could see what he was going, because I think Takahashi's best game this season was that Kobe game. So I could see why he went with him, with Nagai. But yeah, there were a couple of times they linked up, but the quality wasn't quite there.
Yeah, so Tokyo can't really, you know, have any complaints. There was that one chance that wasn't taken, and then they were punished. And, yeah, Stuart, Eric made it 2-0 just before half-time. And if we didn't know, the title was heading your way after the first goal, we absolutely did after the second. Another superb finish from this mid-season signing. He's made such a huge difference. Obviously, brought in basically to replace Edgar Junior, and 8 goals in 12, I think, to finish the season. Is an absolutely remarkable return. Another clinical finish, and, what a masterstroke by the front office, and to bring him in mid-season.
Yeah, it was really, really a good goal. And as I said, I think on the last podcast, like, if he gets the ball in the box, he's going to score. So and he was grappled and pulled and still managed to get a foot to it and score that goal. And I noticed even just a couple of minutes before that, there was all of this kind of said. The argy bargy play, and he was rolling around and complaining to the referee, and then suddenly he's got the ball and he's running there and scored. So he's not rattled by that, I think, that kind of play at all. So yeah, fantastic signing. And I wonder if he came through a recommendation from Thiago, because I seem to have read that Eric was just on the bench and only coming on for, you know, a few minutes in his previous club. So I think he was really happy to play and jumped straight in there.
Well, I'll tell you what, any team that wants to have a decent crack next season would, rather than trying to sign the foreigners that Yokohama have brought in, they should just try and sign their Brazilian scouts, because they've done an absolutely remarkable job bringing in Thiago Martins, Eric Marcos Junior, of course, a joint Golden Boot winner, and for good measure, Mateus as well, who has been important down the stretch. So absolutely terrific stuff. I mean, obviously there was the controversy about the red card for the goalkeeper Park Il-gyu, who was he brought down Kensuke Nagai just after the hour, but he didn't leave the pitch until there was about 20 minutes left. I think he hugged all of his teammates and went over to the other side of the pitch and hugged all of the ball boys and ball girls over there as well. He certainly made the most of his exit, did Park, but there was no real sustained period of pressure on the Yokohama goal after Park was sent off, even though Yokohama were down to 10 men. And of course, Keita Endo applied the finishing touches when he dribbled from 10, 15 yards inside his own half, and turned Yoshi Watanabe inside out before firing home the third goal to put the icing very much on the cake and seal the win on the afternoon for Yokohama. And as I say, the title was already well and truly wrapped up by then. So, this is, I think I mentioned it last week, it's the third season in a row where a team has peaked at just the right time. And, Yokohama were 5th 12 games ago, and then to go on 11 games ago, maybe 5th 11 games ago, and then to go on this run and, ultimately win the league by 6 points is absolutely remarkable. There was a lot said in the build-up, Sean, about Ange Postecoglou and the progress he's made in the 2 seasons he's been in charge, to take his side to a title, having timed their run to absolute perfection in the second season is a credit to him and to all of his staff and all of the players as well. A remarkable achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, he came in fairly highly rated, and it was a bit of a left field appointment, I guess, for a J League club. And I think from people I've spoken to in Australia, it seemed like it was, quite a few people were surprised that he took that job. Obviously, he left the Australian national team job and the chance of going to the World Cup to take it. But yeah, I don't think many people, except perhaps for our friend Scott McIntyre, who was very, very keen to blow his trumpet when Postecoglou arrived and say he was going to have a huge impact. And I think, yeah, we have to take our hats off there. Scott was right on the money. He's done an absolutely sensational job. And, you know, he really does look like he's got this ability to bring teams together and get them playing exactly what he wants. He was incredibly, cut an incredibly assured figure afterwards. He was talking, you know, in the press conference afterwards and in a few interviews I've seen with him since, where he said that, you know, he never had any doubts and he knows that his methods can get success. It's just a case of being given the time to do it and having the right players at his disposal to be able to. And obviously, you know, in club football, it's maybe a bit easier to do because you can, as you said, if you've got a good scouting setup and a club that will back you, obviously they're helped a lot by City Football Group, who I understand, while they don't force signings onto the club, in my understanding, they're there. Obviously, they've got a huge scouting network and are able to supplement, you know, what the club and the coaches are doing themselves and offer solutions if they're told what kind of players to look for. And I think in that regard, you know, he's pretty much changed the squad. Stuart will obviously know more than we do exactly how many players have come and gone and whatever, and, you know, how he's kind of changed the mood within the club. But, you know, a lot of the players that are there now weren't there when he arrived. He's really built the team in his image. And yeah, to win the league with essentially a new team, if you talk about the ones out on the pitch, inside just 2 years, and to have done it in such emphatic fashion is really quite something. Actually, I just wondered if I could ask Stuart a question. Obviously, Postecoglou's got I wouldn't say frosty, but, you know, he's not one of those coaches like you see some of the, perhaps the Brazilian coaches who come over here and they really form a kind of warm bond with the fans and they're there celebrating with them and they're on the megaphone and stuff. And Postecoglou seems to be far more kind of restrained in that regard. I just wonder obviously fans are hugely fond of him for what he's done with the team and stuff, but what do fans think of him? You know, what's the connection like between the coach and the fans?
Well, I think what you see on the TV and you know, what you see at the fan service, I think he's very warm at the fan service and you know, just is thoroughly involved in that. Like, there was a picture the other day, like, and I have a big Postecoglou flag that I made, and there's about 20 more flags that various people have made with his face on. And last year when we had the Kobe match, where it was a little bit doubtful, where we were in a bit of a losing streak at that point, the core leader put up the big banner, which is "We trust our boss," and at that match, I think, was a turning point with Kubo's goal and running into his arms there. And it really, I think the fans really like him. And, you know, I've talked to the fans and said, well, what do you think of him compared to the previous manager? And, like, Eric Mombets really wasn't liked much at all. And I think they said, like, Mombets' football was boring. You know, they didn't like it, but Postecoglou, they can see how it works. Like, I think the fans could see what he was trying to do, and you know, it was a little bit crazy at the start. You know, a little bit nerve wracking, but once you saw how, you know, the ball could go sideways, almost to the corner, and then within a few incisive passes, be right up and score a goal, then it kind of clicked and say, wow, we can see what he's trying to do there. So he's really well loved by the fans, and everybody wants to see him stay the full year, definitely, and hope he has the success. And I read his book, you know, pretty much after he joined, just to see who he was. And he's very much into making a legacy. Like, if there is a, you know, the title to be won, then let's win it twice. And that means that no match is you know, a throwaway match, because you know, we're going for the second title. You know, every match counts there. So it's really you know, kind of a inspirational manager, and I think the fans are just totally full on board. And if you like, I listened also to his full press conference as well, and he's talking, you know, very, very much more candidly, and has said, you know, about the players and how on also on one of the news programs, how Keita had really been leading the team, you know, as a young player from a Yokohama player coming up for the academy, has really taken on board the philosophy and got everybody else on board too. And he was, you know, very impressed with him. So, yeah, I think the players also seem to like him. And yeah, as we said, you know, the signings have really been the turning point, I think, this year.
Yeah, well, they've played a huge part, but yeah, no one's played a bigger role than the J1 Player of the Year, Teruhito Nakagawa. He was officially crowned on Sunday night at the J-League Awards, although he wasn't there, of course, because he's in South Korea with the Japan squad for the East Asian Cup. I tell you what, Sam, this is a result for us, I think. I think we were calling Nakagawa at least to be in the best 11, probably, you know, 10 or 12 games into the season. He'd made such an important early impact for Yokohama. Little did we know at that stage that he would go on to be pretty much a unanimous pick for Player of the Year, but he's absolutely deserved it. And you think about where he's come from. 2 years ago was on loan at Fukuoka in J2, and the season before that he was with Machida. So he came back in when into the fold at Yokohama when Ange Postecoglou took over. Obviously had a somewhat of a breakout season last year. I think it was 9 league goals, but yeah, really, really made his name for himself this season with 15 goals, sharing the golden boot with his teammate Marcos Junior, and maybe finishing second, I think, in the assist table. It depends which assist table you read. From what I've seen on the official J-League accounts on social media, I think Nagato from Sendai might have pipped him, but he was very close to taking that title as well. A phenomenal season from the wee man.
Yeah, we've finally got a prediction right, so I'll hang my hat on that one. But yeah, full credit to both him and the manager, because as you say, at Vispa, I mean, he was playing up front, he couldn't really hit a barn door to save his life, and he's been transformed in the last two seasons, moved more so out onto the right-hand side, but his movement is so good, he finds spaces when no one else would, he's got that rapid pace that just tears defenders apart, and the last couple of seasons he's added like a clinical edge to his game. He's always... You always expect him to at least hit the target. He's, yeah, scoring goals. He's got such a good link with first. It was Marcos Junior and Edigo Junior. That was a superb little trio. Now Eric has come in. It's kind of made that front line even more dynamic, because Edigo Junior was kind of a box player and he'd just score from there, but Eric can move all over the place. So it's so difficult for defences to deal with. And it has to go down to the way... to the manager, I'm sure, because he's just developed Nakagawa into the best player in the league this season. I mean, I think it was the easiest decision that anyone could have ever made, was to pick Nakagawa as the MVP for this season. He's just been superb. But I'm going to take a leaf out of Sean's book and ask Stuart a question. I just want to see, where does he think this squad is going to go next season? Obviously, juggling the ACL as well as the league. Especially the last couple of seasons, the likes of Kashima and Arara have done well in the ACL, but with a much more pragmatic approach, but more defensive-minded. Do you see Ange in any way straying from his principles and looking to shore up things a bit more for the ACL, or do you think that attacking brand of football will just be carried on and see where it gets you in the ACL?
I'm pretty sure that he'll just continue as is. It's interesting, like... be interesting to see who of the loan players that we can keep on, because you know, it'd be very useful to have Matthias in the squad too, but it looks like he'll be going back to Nagoya. I think Teraton has been signed for a permanent position. So I think that's steady. And I think the other Brazilian players still have another year on their contracts. But difficult to say at this point. I think in the next few weeks we'll see all of those the news of the contract renewals. But hopefully the whole squad will remain. I don't think anybody's going to run away. Some players might be called back to their respective squads, and maybe we'll get a few more to firm up the squad a little bit for the extra matches. But I think he's definitely going to play the same style and carry on as before. It'd be very interesting to see how that works out.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Well, it was a superb performance on the day by Yokohama, ultimately running out comfortable. The 3-0 winners, FC Tokyo, unable to really seriously trouble them throughout the 90 minutes. A deserved win on the day, and a deserved title, the fourth in Yokohama's history. And interesting questions from you both there, Sean and Sam too, Stuart. And I wonder, this time last year, obviously we were asking Neil Debnam what Kawasaki would do for an encore after their second straight title, and whether they would put more priorities towards the ACL. Of course, they signed Leandro Damião/Damian, and it didn't quite pan out, did it, for them in Asia or in the league this season. But you imagine they'll be reloading for another crack at the top flight title, and maybe in Asia as well if Kashima win the Emperor's Cup. All right, Stuart, well, we'll get you out of here in a few minutes, but I want to know, and I'm sure the listeners are curious as well, how all the celebrations went on the Saturday evening / night, probably into a Sunday as well. I was there with my mate Graham, and we clapped the FC Tokyo players off when they came around to bow in front of the away end, and then we were off pretty sharpish. Obviously, a crowd of over 63,000. You want to get out of there fairly quickly if there's not much reason for you to hang around, but I imagine you did. And what do you remember of the night afterwards? Because I'm sure it was a fairly big one.
Well, I hung around until the very end, and it's a really nice send-off to Yuzo Kurihara. He gave a very nice speech, a very witty and humble speech. So he's hanging up his boots. I think he's going to stay on with the club in some form or another. But it's like kind of final words are like, I'm standing here. This is my retirement speech, and I'm very cold. Okay. And I'm really relieved that we won, because I don't think you want to give that speech if we just lost everything at that point. But all credit to the FC Tokyo fans, though. Did you see that video that was taken of the players and the fans singing them off? That was really I think it was on J-League site. It was really fantastic. The whole two levels of scarves and banners held up, everything there. It'd be really nice to see, that many away fans at every match, because the local team certainly could fill up that the cavernous area at the away end much better. So that was really, a great tribute to the Tokyo fans. As for the celebrations, so we had a quick run down to the hub to reclaim our table, which is on permanent reservation after the match, and had a bottle of champagne there. And then my group had a party for about 20 or so in a Chinese restaurant nearby. But I was feeling really burnt out at the end of the day, and so I took the family home on the train and just really collapsed. But I've seen the videos of what went on, and in Yokohama, the main street of Noge is the supporter bar, Shaver, and that's kind of the spiritual whole of, spiritual home of the behind the goal supporters. You know, some of them are working as bar staff there, and if you go in there, you'll always see people who would be standing up behind the goal. And so outside of there, there was absolute chaos. The ultra groups had a big party in Noggin, a restaurant, and then they came out of the restaurant with their drums and walked round the road. And so there were people, continuing singing the supporter songs in the street. And then eventually the police came down the street to ask them to tone it down a bit, and because it was getting pretty late at that point. So I think they all probably went back inside the bar and continued on their 3,000 yen all night nomihodai, which seems very good value. I think I missed a good chance there for that one. But on Instagram you can see the scenes of mayhem there that were going on. So they were all really enjoying late into the night.
All right then. Well, big celebrations for a big achievement. Absolutely terrific end to the season by Yokohama, and deserve the champions, as we've all said. So once again, Stuart, massive congratulations. And this will obviously be the last time you're on the podcast this year. So I did want to say thank you very much for all of your input throughout the season. Obviously, you took over from Sean Galbraith as our Yokohama correspondent, and I very much appreciate, and I'm sure the listeners do as well, your thoughts every time you've been on. And on top of that, of course, the two ground hopping specials we've done with Chris Huff have been really well received. So Stuart, very much appreciate it, and I'm sure the celebrations haven't finished yet, so I'm sure you'll be back into it on Tuesday and probably for the rest of the week as well. But for now, thanks ever so much, and congratulations again.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think Sean might be available next year. I'm dropping him in it there. He's back at the matches now. He's able to come to the matches, so you might be able to get a different input from him. And also, thanks very much for the 300 episodes. When I started in around 2013, I really didn't know anything about the J League or anything of the history or which club was which. And thanks very much for all your contributions too.
Very much appreciated. All right, well, my thanks again, and a big congratulations to Stuart Woodward and all the Yokohama F Marino supporters. We've had quite a few on the podcast over the course of the 300 episodes, so to all of them, a big congratulations as well. All right, so after a quick hit of music, Sean and Sam and I will round up the rest of the Match Day 34 slate. Okay, well, thanks again to Stuart. Okay, let's move on to the other two games that had the most riding on them on the final match day of the J1 season, and they were both down at the foot of the table, of course. The loser leaves town match at Nihon Daira between Shimizu and Tosu was, for most, the main event, and it was the game that you chose to watch live on Saturday afternoon, Sam. As we've said earlier, we basically all knew that Yokohama were winning the league. So there was a lot riding on this game, and I guess it didn't lack for tension, but it also lacked for quality. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I don't think anyone came into this game expecting it to be two top quality teams going at each other. It was riddled with mistakes for most of the game. Shimizu have been defensively awful all season, and they gave up two really good opportunities for Tosu with some pretty average defending. Huang Shoko with one awful back pass. But Tosu didn't really take advantage of any of that. They had a couple of half chances through Toyota, but really for a good 60 minutes of this game, there was no quality at all. It took the one player on the pitch in Douglas to really bring the game to life. A great little goal. Starting out on the right-hand side, he cut back inside, left-footed strike into the top corner. No chance for the Tapioca in goal, and that was all it took to really to break this deadlock. And they were probably just about worthy of it, S-Pulse. They offered a little bit more in attack, But these were two pretty poor sides, and they're quite lucky that the kind of booking that we had of Loser Leaves Town didn't really come to fruition, as we'll go on to, Shonan decided to drop a load in the last few minutes against Matsumoto. But yeah, these were pretty poor sides, and they've got a lot of work to do, both of them, going into next season, although S-Pulse obviously could still end up in Asia if they win the Emperor's Cup, which I don't think they'd perform too well in that next season. But yeah, I mean, yeah, Tosu as well, that they've had such a strange season with the Torres nonsense that kind of overshadowed them for ages. Their run at the start of the season with, like, was it 6 or 7 games without a goal? They've just not really hit any heights this season. And they've got so much work to do as well, because they're not getting the most out of the likes of Kanazaki up front, or Cuenca, who will probably leave at the end of the season. So two really important off seasons for both teams, and they can count their lucky stars that both have stayed in the division.
Well, yes, Douglas, a spectacular goal with just over 20 minutes to go settled that tie at Nihon Daira, and it obviously ensured S-Pulse's safety, and the Tosu were heading for 16th and the relegation playoff, because Ryunosuke Noda had come onto the pitch in the 83rd minute for Shonan away at Matsumoto, and with his first touch 2 minutes later, took Shonan up to 13th in the live table with his goal. And so, yeah, it looked like it was Tosu heading for the playoff in 16th. But then, Shonan, well, they've had the last 3 months have just been absolutely diabolical for them, obviously. And, yeah, there was another twist in the tale when Toyofumi Sakano's 90th minute equaliser for already relegated Matsumoto saved Sagan's bacon, and shunted Shonan from 13th all the way back down to 16th and into the playoff. So they will host Tokushima at the BMW Stadium on Saturday for the right to remain in J1 for the 2020 season. Obviously, the playoff is heavily weighted in favour of the J1 side. They have home advantage in a one-off game, and they only have to avoid defeat to stay in J1. So, Sean, we'll move on and talk about this game that's coming up on Saturday then. Sean, and hosting Tokushima. You've seen a lot of Tokushima this season. What are your thoughts on how things might play out on Saturday, and how much of a game Tokushima will give Shonan?
I think it's going to be difficult for them. They're very good. They're almost like a less good version of the way Marinos play. Their coach Ricardo Rodriguez likes the team to get the ball down, to work it forward quickly, and they play positive football. They like to attack all the players in central midfield. They kind of play a 3-4-2-1 kind of setup, and the sort of four that play in the middle there, both the defensive midfielders and the two kind of I guess you'd call that the two number tens, constantly looking to try and feed balls in behind to get attacks sparked. And when they come up against teams who are kind of well organized and hard working, they do tend to struggle to score. You know, we saw it against Montedio, who are exactly that kind of team who like to sit tight and compact and keep the game at 0-0 for as long as possible. When teams allow them to kind of have the ball, and, you know, if you don't give them space in behind to attack, they do tend to struggle to come up with alternatives. They don't really have a lethal finisher up front. You know, someone that is, you know, if they get one or two chances a game, they're guaranteed to take it. So it would depend on how many chances Shonan are willing to take. Obviously, Shonan only need a draw. And they're, you know, they're a kind of a dogged team. They'll put in a shift. Against Matsumoto, they had to win. They had to kind of take some risks. But I feel like Shonan, if they play it smart, will initially go in there and try and just take any sting out of the game. Let Tokushima have the ball in their defensive third and in the middle of the pitch, and just make sure they don't invite them sort of in behind the Shonan back line too much. If they can do that, then obviously Shonan have got quality players of their own going forward, and they, you know, they can threaten as they've shown. You know, obviously they put up a decent showing against Tokyo and were maybe unlucky to only be 1-0 up when they got pegged back. And they obviously, you know, like you said, they conceded the 90th minute at the weekend. If they hadn't conceded that, they'd be safe now. So I think they're starting to emerge out the end of the tunnel after, as you said, an absolutely dismal 2 or maybe even 3 months. So I think, yeah, Tokushima will, you know, they've got nothing to lose. They have to go there and try and play. They've played the same way all season. And in fact, pretty much the 3 years that Rodriguez has been there now. And I just think, yeah, if Tokushima can't score fairly early on, then they're going to have their work cut out. They need to capitalize on any nerves that Shonan might be feeling and try to make a breakthrough early on if they want to stand any chance.
All right then. So Sam, have you picked Charlie Houghton's brain yet on how he thinks Tokushima will go against Shonan? And yeah, obviously we know Shonan struggles in recent times. They of course won their last home game 1-0 over Hiroshima, but they'd been tonked by Gunma Osaka, Kawasaki and Shimizu in their previous three before that. So, well, I don't know. Yeah, how do you see it playing out before we move on to the rest of the Match Day 34 fixtures?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Sean's assessment there. I think if Fortis can start well, if they can get ahead in this game, I think that would make them favourites, because obviously I think morale is a little bit on the edge at Shonan. They have had those three pretty good performances against Cerezo and then Tokyo, but coming into that last game against Matsumoto, just kind of that losing their status possibly with the last minute of the game, it's going to affect them, and any sort of positive start from Vortis could put them under pressure. But I do think that a bit in the same manner as Jubilo last season, and with everything kind of heavily weighted in favour of the J1 side, I think they probably will just have a little bit too much nous maybe about them to get over the line. But I'm hopeful for Tokushima. I think there's some good players in there, mainly in midfield, and I like Jordy Boysh at the back. I absolutely love him, the Cavalier centre-back. So I really hope that they can put on a good performance. But, yeah, I think it's just about in Shonan's favour.
All right, then. So for J1 watchers unfamiliar with Tokushima, they, of course, were in the top flight a few seasons ago. They finished fourth in J2 this season. They drew the playoff semi-final at home against Kofu, which, of course, was enough to see them through to the final. And in that J2 playoff final, they defeated Yamagata 1-0 at home this past Sunday. And, yes, now they head to Shonan for the big one, for the right to play in J1 in 2020. All right, so, S-Pulse and Tosu ended up safe, and Matsumoto actually ended up edging back up to 17th in the table above Iwata, who were tonked away at Kobe, which we'll come on to on my running sheet. That's the last game we will cover. Let's move on. And, guys, what I mentioned we might do in the break after we let Stuart go is that, I'd just briefly summarise these games, and then you can, if you wouldn't mind, briefly either summarise their season as a whole or where you think the future lies for this particular team as we wrap everything up at the end of the season. So Kashima ended up securing third spot, and they finally put Nagoya out of their misery. Grampus ending up in 13th, but just a point above Shonan in the playoff spot. It didn't appear to be a classic at the Toyota Stadium, and it was decided a 1-0 in Kashima's favour with the only goal of the game, a Shinosuke Nakatani own goal 2 minutes before half time. Kashima finished third, and of course they do still have an Empress Cup semi-final to come against Nagasaki on the 21st. I should have mentioned before we moved off for Shimizu that they will play Kobe, of course, in the other Emperor's Cup semi-final in 2 Saturdays' time. So, Sam, why don't you go first? You can talk briefly about either Nagoya or Kashima. Keep in mind you're leaving the other team for Sean.
Yeah, well, I know he likes Kento Misao, so I'll go for Nagoya. They obviously had a tumultuous season, like, started off really well, looked like they might be an ACL competitor, and have just sank like a stone since. They're going to have such an important off-season, because Ficcadenti is going to have to completely revamp that team to get it in anywhere near his image, because that team is not set up for a defensive-minded coach. So there's going to be a lot of movement. I would imagine that Joe would probably leave. I think, obviously, he was in the team of the year last year, but this season he's been dreadful. He's not offered a lot up front, and the kind of key players that they've usually had in Xavier has not really got much of a look in under Ficcadenti. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of movement, I imagine, at Nagoya, and it'll be interesting to see how well Ficcadenti can deal with that, because after his season with Tokyo, the last where Tosu, he wasn't great, and this, he's not done much really with Grampus, so he has a lot of work to do to kind of get that team playing in the way that he would want them to.
All right, and Antlers are unable to obviously build on their ACL success of last season. Sean, they were top with, four games to go, but have faded down the stretch. We've spoken in recent weeks about whether that's just down to tiredness and, the way their squad has been just taxed through so many injuries over the course of the season. But, a brief summary on Antlers.
Well, yeah, Kento got injured, so they didn't win the league. That's pretty much the cut and thrust of it. If they'd had him fit all season, he wouldn't be Stuart celebrating now, obviously.
Indeed. All right.
I think you've pretty much summed it up there. I think they did have a hell of a lot of injuries. They were really sort of pushing, at one point, maybe with 2 months of the season to go, they were still going in, I think, all four competitions. In the end, they just, they didn't quite have the rubber of the green. They had a little bit too much to do. The fixture list wasn't especially kind to them towards the end. The last sort of handful of games, they had a few fairly big games in there. They didn't quite have enough to last the distance. But, you'd expect them next year again to be pretty much where they always are. They'll always be up in sort of the top four or five, you'd imagine, and in with the shout of at least ACL football, if not the title again next year.
All right. So next to two teams that I guess at the end of the day we'll probably classify as disappointments at the end of the 2019 season. Sapporo hosted Kawasaki. It finished 2-1 to Frontale up at the Sapporo Dome. It meant that Kawasaki sealed fourth spot ahead of Cerezo Osaka and ensured they will enter the ACL group stage playoffs if Kashima win the Emperor's Cup. Yu Kobayashi scored in the very first minute, and Yasuto Wakisaka took advantage of our old mate Gu Sung-yun, basically offering him half of the goal at his near post to aim at a free kick, and Wakisaka duly obliged and stroked home after 13 minutes to make it 2-0. Then Frontale managed to hang on after Lucas Fernandez's volley got Consadole back into the contest just past the half hour. So the two-time champions Kawasaki ended up fourth, and Sapporo slipped down into the bottom half of the table, actually, with this loss, and ended up 10th. Obviously, a disappointing return after their best ever finish of fourth last season. It was probably a bit of a stretch to expect them to match that. We will see. And we'll see which team Sean decides to talk about here, either Sapporo or Kawasaki. Take it away, mate.
They're both fairly tempting. I think I'll probably go with Kawasaki just because I think, I saw them live most recently, obviously against Marinos. And I did feel in that game there was something. Obviously, Marinos have been in such scintillating form at the end of the season. You hesitate to read too much into it. But it did look a little bit like a kind of passing of the baton, and the way Marinos are playing. Obviously, Kawasaki play some very nice football, and they've earned a lot of plaudits over the last, not only the last 2 years when they won the league, but even before that under Kazuma, they were playing some nice stuff. But it all looks a little bit. It looked a little bit static. They looked a little bit stale in the face of Marinos. Marinos were just pressing. They were so much quicker. They were so much more intent. Kawasaki looked a bit more like, you know, possession for possession's sake, whereas Marinos had far more cut and thrust about them. I mean, that could have just been because, you know, Kawasaki were only playing for a potential ACL spot, where Marinos had the bit between their teeth and knew that they had to just keep grinding out the wins to get the title. But yeah, I did just sense there was maybe something, you know, if you look at the Premier League now as well, Liverpool and Manchester City, you know, that you get these kind of waves in the style of football, and which ones are successful. And I did think then that perhaps, obviously Kawasaki don't want to change the way they're playing, it's nothing that drastic, but maybe trying to freshen up the team a little bit, you know, Akihiro Ienaga and these kind of players, they're good players, but they look a little bit like they're kind of coasting, they're not really pushing themselves. Defensively, I'm still not completely sold on the likes of Taniguchi and these kind of players, and perhaps, you know, over the off-season, if Kawasaki can make a few changes and just try and kind of freshen the team up a little bit, I thought that, you know, maybe that's just something they need for next year, now that perhaps their reign as, you know, as the team, the number one team in the J-League, the team to beat, is maybe sort of coming to an end.
Indeed, indeed. All right, Sam, well, Sean has left Sapporo for you then.
Yeah, it's been an interesting season. I think 10th, I think, is a little bit harsh on them. I think they've played pretty well most of the year, not quite to the heights of last season, of course, but they got that Levan Cup final where they were so unlucky to lose on penalties to Kawasaki. And another interesting off-season, because there are players there that could move on. If you look at Ryosuke Shindo, one of my favourite players, I think a team should be eyeing him up. Maybe Fukumori as well, who are possibly the best delivery in the league. And those two are really good players. But the rest, like midfield, maybe needs a freshen up, a bit like Kawasaki. But Arano, Fukai, and Miyazawa, they're decent players, but there are areas that I think Sapporo could improve. Obviously, Bothroyd is going to be another year older. I don't think they'll get as much out of him. And Musashi Suzuki, although he's got into the national team this year, he's not necessarily the most clinical finisher. So there are areas to improve, but I think they'll stick with the philosophy that Misha Petrovic brings, which has done quite well for Sapporo. They've taken them to another level. So I think they'll be satisfied with this season, but they'll know there's areas to improve on.
All right, Sam, you've mentioned Akito Fukumori there. That might be a good time to take a little break and talk about the J1 Best 11 that was announced at the J-League Awards on Sunday night, because, the team was, well, it was dominated by second-placed finishing FC Tokyo, who had six members of the team. There were four from the champions, Yokohama, and according to the announcer in the venue, FC Tokyo actually had seven members of the best 11, because they said FC Tokyo, Andres Iniesta, but yes, I believe he plays for Kobe, but they that was an interesting interlude there. But so Sam, you took the trouble to actually post your team of the season before the J-Leagues was announced, and Fukumori was in yours. You obviously went for a balance of players from a number of different teams. I'm looking at it right now in front of me and trying to calculate while I'm speaking at the same time. I reckon you've got players from at least seven different teams in there, so you would have been quite surprised, I presume, to see the team totally dominated by Tokyo and Yokohama.
Well, I don't know if I'm surprised. That's kind of the way they go each season. I was slightly surprised that anyone who's played left-hand side of defence isn't going to get a look in, because I fancy two centre-backs and a right-back as the back three, and just four up front in a 3-3-4 formation. But yeah, I thought the league was a lot more balanced than the J1 team of the year would suggest. I don't think there's too much between a lot of teams. I think, obviously, Yokohama's attack is very good, and that's why you'd have Nakagawa and Marcos Jr. in there, and that's where they've probably won the league. But I think, especially defensively, I think there are better teams out there, like Cerezo Osaka have got such a good defensive record, so I'd have had Matej Jonjic in there at centre-back, and, I mean, goalkeepers, there's not many in J1 that are in any way consistent, so it's picking out of a hat, really. But I went with Kim Jin-hyun in there. I think he's been pretty solid. But, yeah, I think there's definitely good players out there in the league that I think deserved a bit more recognition. Like, and Iniesta was in there. Obviously, he's the best player on his day by a country mile, but he's missed a third of the season through injury, so I'm not really sure how you can have him in there. So, yeah, I'd like to see a bit more variety, but, I mean, these awards, it always seems to go to the top few teams, the players in that team, so I wasn't really that surprised.
Fair enough then, and well, yeah, Sean, you're a veteran of these events, of course, so I'm sure you weren't surprised either, but, I mean, Sam made a good point on Twitter last night. I mean, if they're going to pretend they're going to play a 3-3-4 formation, why don't they just name 11 players regardless of position and just say that they are the best 11 players of the season?
Yeah, but then if you do that, you're going to get what you get with El Golazo, where the best 11 is just whoever scored goals every week. Like, you see that, and it's just this left-back scored a goal, this centre-back scored a goal, and they get in there. So I can see why they have to have some kind of semblance. I mean, for me, I always find these awards kind of ridiculous anyway. I mean, you know, football is a team sport. So at the end of the year, Marinos were the best team. They won the title. I mean, you know, obviously Nakagawa's had an excellent season, but I kind of tend to disagree with the fact, you know, everyone's been saying tonight that it was obvious he was going to win. I still, you know, when it got to like 2-3 weeks of the season to go, I was thinking, well, who is the player of the season going to be? No one for me really jumped out. I mean, Marinos, obviously Nakagawa has been there at the pointy end with the goals and the assists, and that tends to be where the awards go. But the way they play really is about the team. You know, every player is a vital cog in the way they play. And as you saw last year when, you know, as Postecoglou himself has kind of said, that there were maybe players there that weren't, not necessarily bad players, but not able to play the style of football they want, then things didn't go as well for them. So I think, you know, when you've got a team that is built around team play and working as a unit, it's kind of hard to then single out an individual. But, you know, you could argue the same as last year. Ian Agger won because he was kind of the most famous player that wasn't Yu Kobayashi or Kengo Nakamura, who had won it in previous years. So I tend to find these award ceremonies a bit of a waste of time. It's almost like a marketing ploy from whoever's running it, whether it's the J-League, whether it's FIFA or whatever. You know, so that's why Iniesta's in there, because now in the history books, Iniesta is going to be listed in the J-League Best 11. David Villa won Goal of the Season, so David Villa will now be, you know, marked down in Japanese football history. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, at the moment, people are looking at this and going, well, obviously Iniesta's a fantastic player. It's Andres Iniesta, but he doesn't deserve to be in the 11 this year. But in 10, 20, 30, 50 years, people will look back and they'll be able to do these reflections on previous years. And, you know, people then aren't going to think about the fact that, well, actually, maybe that year it should have been Kento Misao instead of Andres Iniesta. Just to pluck a name from thin air there.
Oh, yes, completely random, completely random.
Yep.
Very good, very good. All right, well, yeah, the less said about the J-League Awards, and in particular the somewhat questionable choice of celebrities they had to present, and, yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just an absolute catastrophe, Sean's point about the awards themselves is well made. All right, so we do have four games left to go. It's probably best that we move on. And the teams that rounded out the top six were Cerezo Osaka and Hiroshima. Both won on the final day. Down in Kyushu in Oita, Cerezo won 2-0. A trademark free kick from Souza gave Cerezo a first-half lead. And then Hiroaki Okuno wrapped up the points in the second half. Cerezo finished fifth. Oita ended up ninth after their late season fade out that saw them win just one of their last five. But I would say still a remarkable achievement from them to finish in the top half of the table when we all had them penciled in to finish bottom at the start of the season. Sean, which of these two teams would you like to briefly chat about?
Oh God!
Well, I'll tell you what, Sean. I'll ask you a question. Actually, I know it was a question without notice, but you appeared on the Asian Game podcast with Paul Williams last week in the lead up to the final day of the season, and Paul asked you for some surprises some teams or players or etc. that had surprised you in the 2019 season? And I admit to being surprised that that you didn't mention Oita. I know it was a question without notice, and maybe they weren't on the tip of your tongue. But yeah, they've been a remarkable story pretty much all season, haven't they?
Yes, they have. I have to admit that I was surprised as well once I hung up on the call with Paul Williams. I've completely forgotten about them. I'll have to say that, yeah, as you said, it was a unprompted question I wasn't aware was coming. And to be honest, part of it as well was, you know, they've been so consistent throughout the year as well that I almost forgot that it was only this year they'd come up. You know, they really settled in so quickly up in the top flight. They were really playing some good football. They never really, you know, often when a team does come up and maybe starts quite well, they fade away a bit. And as you said, at the end of the season, they did drop off, but that was once they knew they were safe and they knew they weren't really going to make a challenge for the ACL. And, you know, it's understandable that maybe they started to coast a bit. So yeah, I had kind of forgotten about them, and I did think afterwards, well, they were probably the obvious one to go with. So yeah, I guess I'll talk about them now, seeing as I've started to. And yeah, having come up from J2 last year, they were you know, they were decent in J2, but they still got reasonably lucky to get the promotion. I think I'm right in saying their last game was away to Montedio last year when they sealed their promotion, and I've got a feeling they conceded late on in that game, and it only went up because somebody else that was chasing promotion with them didn't get the result they needed. So they, you know, they only kind of snuck over the line, and they'd been a decent team throughout the season, but never really dominated. So the fact that they did do so well this year is really a testament to the coach there, Katanosaka, obviously, and it's also a testament, I think, and something that maybe the team's been promoted this year from J2 could learn from, in that they didn't really rock the boat too much. They just stuck with the same style of football. They brought in players. They didn't really go for too many players that have just been in J1 before, so they just think, well, we'll bring them in, or agents have sort of thrusted them upon them. They brought in players that they thought would fit their style. And I think that's something that's definitely recommended. You know, there isn't such a huge gap between J1 and J2. You know, a lot of the teams up in the top, say, top 6, 7, 8 in J2, on their day could be any of the teams in the bottom 6, 7, 8 in J1. And it's just a case of coming up and having that consistency and that confidence. And hopefully what Oita have done this year will, you know, obviously act as some kind of inspiration for, well, Yokohama FC might be a bit of a stretch. They're going to need to certainly bolster their squad in some ways, because they've got an average age of about 43. But yeah, whoever... If Tokushima are able to get past Shonan, then I think it would be certainly be a good Oita could serve as almost like a good role model for them to just stick to the style of football they're playing, not take out too many of the players that got them there, and you know, it shows that it can be done.
Most definitely. And well, yes, Sam, we'll move on and get your thoughts on Cerezo Osaka. But yeah, just piggybacking what Sean's mentioned there, I think for Oita, the big issue is going to be avoiding doing what Shonan did the last time that they were up before coming back up this past time, if you catch my drift. I think they came up, two times ago and finished eighth, surprising us all. But then, yeah, they didn't kick on at all, and I think they were relegated the following season. So they deserve enormous credit for what they've done throughout the entire season, as Sean says. But the encore is what really counts. If they can cement themselves as a J1 occupant, or whether they're going to be a yo-yo club similar to Shonan, is the challenge before them, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be quite a difficult season next year. They already lost Fujimoto this season, and Ado Anayo is going back to Red. So that's the two really good strikers that they're going to be missing, so it's going to be difficult for them to replace those goals. Plus, a lot of those players have really impressed this season, so you can see other clubs probably sniffing around the likes of Iwata at the back. I think he could be a target for a so-called bigger club. So it's going to be the second season syndrome, as they call it. I think they might be in for a bit of more of a struggle. Like, teams will probably have figured them out a little bit more. Like, they kind of surprised everyone, I think, with the way they were playing at the start of the season and sitting up in fourth or so for so long. And Obviously, this kind of slight decline at the end of the season has been a little bit to do with them being safe and kind of taking their foot off the pedal a little bit. But I think teams have figured out a little bit how to play them. So they're going to have to kind of not necessarily revamp, but they need to add a little bit more quality, I think. Because next season, I think I'd have them closer to the relegation zone than I would the ACL places as it stands at the moment.
All right then, and yeah. So what of Cerezo Osaka, Sam? They've finished the season in pretty good shape, and ultimately good value for their fifth place finish, I would say.
Yeah, they've been very good. They're not very easy on the eye. They're very rigid in the way that they play. Lottina has them set up, and everyone has their certain position. They don't really allow to stray from that position, which kind of cost Souza his place a little bit during the middle of the season. Because, I mean, he's a bit more flair than Lottner quite likes in his team, but they've done really well. They've not really had an out-and-out goal scorer, because with Tokura got injured pretty early on, and Bruno Mendes as well got injured. So they haven't really had much firepower, and Kiyotake is always injured, so that hasn't helped them. But they've just been really solid, and I think he's done a wonderful job. And Katsunosaka definitely deserves the Manager of the Year award, but I thought Lottina's team has really done well, and they were in and around the ACL places for a long time, and I thought, yeah, I think they've had a very good season and will only improve next year, I think.
All right then. So, yeah, Hiroshima ended up sixth. They claimed a final day victory at home over Sendai thanks to Leandro Pereira. He lashed in the only goal of the game with 12 minutes left. Vegalta Sendai ended up in 11th. I guess you would say the best of the rest, the best of the relegation battlers some of them were in danger, obviously, right up until the end or at the final day of the season. So I think both of these teams have really failed to excite for a large amount of the season. I don't want to do a disservice to the supporters of either of these clubs, but I think we can move off them fairly quickly. Sam, I'm sure you don't really want to have to choose one of these two teams, but I'm throwing it back into your court.
Well, I've got a little bit of breaking news I've just seen on Twitter about Vegalta Sendai. Apparently, Mr. Watanabe is set to be sacked, which seems very harsh to me. I think their team has, the squad quality has got worse and worse for the last few seasons, but they still managed to keep them in and around that 11th place. So I think he's done a really good job, but apparently they fancy a change of atmosphere there, so I'm not really sure how well that's going to go. I think they're very inconsistent. They win a game, lose a game. They've not got too much quality, as I said, but I think he's done really well to keep them fairly safe again this season. So, yeah, it's a surprising bit of news to me. I'm not sure your two's opinion on that.
Well, yeah, that is a bit of a bombshell, and it'll be really interesting to see if that does happen, how much ambition they show in terms of the name of the new manager they go after. Watanabe, very steady. His team's, not always the easiest on the eye, but he tends to get results when he needs to. And, whether they have bigger ambitions in the Vegalta front office and want to, try and kick on a bit will, remains to be seen. But, for me, I'm as surprised as you are, Sam. But, we'll see what they've got up their sleeves. Sean, any thoughts on that situation before we wrap up Hiroshima?
I wouldn't say I'm that surprised. I think there's a bit of a risk that it could be a bit like, what can you call it? You can call it maybe Kerbishley syndrome. I remember when Charlton Athletic were, pretty much established in the Premier League under Kerbishley, and they'd made a couple of kind of vague attempts at pushing on into the, maybe getting into Europe, and then dropped away. And then the club started to get ideas that they wanted to move up to that next level. They got rid of that steady pair of hands, and obviously things went downhill from there. So, you could see it in that way, that maybe, a club the size of Sendai, whatever, should kind of be happy to be safe and to be steady where they are in the league, and maybe, look for gradual progression. But at the same time, Watanabe, he's been there a long time. I think he took over when Graham Arnold had his half an hour in charge, right? It was something like that.
That's right, yeah.
So I think he's been there now. That's got to be, how long ago was that? is it 5 years ago? Maybe
sounds
more?
Sounds about right, yeah.
I don't have it in front of me now, but that's a reasonable amount of time, and maybe it is a good time to freshen things up a bit, just to change the mood around the team, maybe change a little bit of, you know, which players are there. You sometimes wonder with these smaller clubs if things do get a little bit set, if the established players maybe carry a bit too much weight and things just become a little bit stagnant. And maybe they're thinking that it's, you know, they had another fairly steady season, but as you said, they're a sort of a win one, lose one, draw one team, and maybe they're thinking they need to shuffle the deck a bit. And yeah, as you said, he's done very well. I'm sure he won't be without offers, if not other J1 clubs, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of clubs down in J2 that would be very interested in bringing him in. And so yeah, maybe it could be best for both parties. Is for just a bit of a change of scenery and freshening things up.
All right then. So quickly then, Sean, on Hiroshima, their season. They were obviously early pace setters again, as they were last season. They were reeled in by FC Tokyo in the first couple of months of the season, and from there, they've kind of hovered between third and sixth for the remainder of the season. So does this version of Sunfrecce get a pass mark from you? And what are their sort of prospects moving forward, do you think?
I think it does. I'm surprised at how well they've done under Hiroshi Jofuku. And again, they're maybe not one of the most exciting teams to watch in the league. They've got some decent individual players and they have their moments, but they're very much set up to be solid. You know what you're going to get with them. Which is probably why they do ultimately fade away, at the start of the season. Maybe Jofuku has the players really sort of in good fitness and knowing exactly what they're doing, and they're sharp and they can get out of the traps quickly. But once teams know what to expect and how they're going to play, they don't really have a plan B or a plan C. And I think, they're steady. They're probably round about where they should be. I think, I would say they're a comfortably top half of the table club. And I think I saw that Jofuku will be sticking around again next year. I certainly wouldn't think they're going to be doing much better than they've done the last couple of years. But I wouldn't imagine they'll drop off much either. So yeah, another mid-table and then, possibly an outside shot of being the mix for the ACL. But no, they've had another decent enough season, and I don't think anyone down there involved with the club will be too disappointed with how things ended.
Yeah, fair enough. Decent enough finish for Sunfrecce. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what they do in this off season, and indeed in the 2020 season. All right, we've got two games to go, and they happen to be the two highest scoring games of the match day 34 slate. At the Saitama Stadium, a bumper crowd of over 47,000 saw Gamba Osaka beat the home team 3-2. A large majority of the supporters went home upset, but the result wasn't necessarily a one. Takashi Usami gave Gamba an early lead. Yosuke Kashiwagi equalised with a brilliant free kick just past the hour, but Adam Milson and Yuya Fukuda made it 3-1 before Fabricio's 90th minute consolation. All right, Sean, it's probably your turn to go first. So, Urawa or Gamba for you?
Oh, it's got to be Urawa. It's got to be. where do you start? I guess we can start with the fact that I predicted them to win the league this year. So I was a little bit off, in that regard. What an absolute mess of a club. They've just got so much going for them, and the fact that they've underachieved so spectacularly, it's hard to know. Again, I think they're another club that maybe need to freshen things up. The playing staff hasn't really changed, and the core of the team, Shinzo Koroki is still far and away their best player and the one that carries them. Obviously, Yosuke Kashiwagi struggled with injuries this year. which didn't help. And they just play such unadventurous football when they've got so much, you know, they've got so many kind of talented players that can do stuff going forwards. The ACL final was a prime example of it. The second leg, they had to be wary of conceding an away goal, but they were just so reactive, just knocking the ball around at the back. I think Shusaku Nishikawa in that game was there, made like the second or third most passes in the team, in the continental final, in a game that you have to score goals. It's mind boggling. The manager Rodsky obviously is carrying, seems to be carrying a hell of a lot of chips around on his shoulder for one reason or another. He's incredibly gruff, seems to have a real attitude, which it can't be good for the, you know, for sort of the morale in the team. It would have been funny, I think, if they'd been in the promotion relegation playoff spot. Maybe it would have served as more of a warning to the club. They have again announced that they're going to change around the kind of the, I don't know what you call it, the organisation, and, you know, sort of the backroom organisation. They've brought in a couple of new faces and things, but they've announced today or possibly yesterday, I think, maybe that Odsky's going to be kept on next season. And you just think that maybe now would have been a time for either him to say, no, look, it's not worked out. I'll go back to a director of football or a scouting role or whatever he was doing before, and let's bring someone else in and, you know, do look at Marinos' lead and go, let's bring in someone and give them 2 or 3 years to really stamp their authority on it. If they want to clear out half a dozen players or 10 players and bring in new players, let's do it. Because, you know, finishing as low as they have in the table and as miserably as well, you know, losing against one of their biggest rivals at home on the last day. I think their last five games, they probably only got maybe 1 point, I think. And that's probably in the game against Tokyo. It's just been such a miserable end to the season. And the fact that they're sticking with Otsuki next year, it can't be that encouraging for the Reds fans looking ahead. You just wonder what's next for them.
Yeah, what a season it's been at Rowa. So many ups and downs, and in the league, obviously, far more downs than ups. Sam, well, yeah, you had Cerezo Osaka, and you've been left with Gumba as well. Their season, obviously, in a stark contrast to Cerezo, but at the end of the day, they've only finished two spots below them.
Yeah, it's a lot of deja vu, really, with Gamba. Like, they started off the season, as with last season, very poorly. It looked like they might have been in a relegation scrap for a while, and then kind of second half of the season, they've looked a lot better. They obviously brought in Usami and Itaguchi. That's definitely kind of helped them. And it's looked like they're building, and they've had a decent end to the season, a good finish. But can they carry that on into next season? It's what we asked at the end of last season, and they didn't. So, again, there's a lot of work to be done there. There's definitely the basis of a very good team there, but can they keep hold of their best players? They just seem to head off to Europe after 5 or 6 games at Gamba, and then they're left in the same position that they are, and back to Yasuhito Endo to kind of hold things together. So, and it looks like they're going to have another kind of difficult transfer window. I've seen Kosuke Onose has been linked to Marinos and FC Tokyo, and Genta Miura likewise. So that's two big players that they'd have to replace if they had their heads turned. I've seen Tatsuki Nara has been linked to Gamba Osaka, which will probably annoy Neil Debnam especially, but that'd be a decent enough signing. But yeah, it's just, can they carry on this kind of good form at the end of the season? Because there's definitely a good team in there, but they shouldn't really be a team that spends most of their season in the bottom half of the table. They expect to be up near the ACL places, and that'll be the challenge for them next season.
All right, then. So, yes, to the third of the Kansai clubs, then. The final game we have left to review at the Noriva Stadium finished at Kobe 4, Iwata 1. Lucas Podolski finished the season in some style, bagging a hat-trick. And David Vija scored from the penalty spot in the final league game of his storied Korea. Vija's goal came after Dialton, who is also rumoured to be FC Tokyo bound. I've seen in the winter transfer window, but I would rather those rumours go away if possible. Had equalised for Iwata. Maybe I shouldn't even be giving those rumours any airtime at all. But we shall see. Kobe finished hot on the heels of Gamba, and both of those two sides moved above Oita and Sapporo on the final day. Iwata finished bottom. They slipped back below Matsumoto after Yamaga's draw. Their 31 points is the most ever by a team finishing bottom in a single stage season, but that won't be any comfort at all to them, I'm sure, as they head back to J2 with their tails between their legs. All right, Sam, it's the last game, and you get to pick. Would you like to briefly chat about Kobe or Iwata?
I might as well take Kansai 1-2-3 and go with Kobe. I mean, it's been another disappointing season for them. It has to be, with the amount of money they spend, the players that they bring in. They shouldn't be lingering around mid-table. But there are positive signs. I think Torsten Fink has come in. He's improved that team, especially defensively. And he's signed on for next year. So hopefully, because they need some continuity at that club to build something. You're not going to get anywhere by chopping and changing. So hopefully for him, he can kind of have his own way in the transfer window, not have players forced on him just because they've visited Barcelona once. But they've bought in Sakai, was a really good signing, and Vermaelen has helped them out defensively. They've still areas of weakness, especially at the right hand side of that defence, that need to be worked on. And it's going to be interesting to see what competitions they're in next year, because they've obviously got they're two games away from the Champions League, which will help with their goal of being the best team in Asia. There are still areas that need to be sorted out with that team. I imagine Podolski will join Veer in leaving the club at the end of the season, even though, I mean, unless his hat-trick has decided to spur him on to stay, but I can see him going home. He's never really truly integrated into life in Kobe, I don't think, not in the same way that Iniesta has. So it's always going to be interesting with Kobe. You'll see the rumours of everyone out there that's won a World Cup or something that might join them. It could cause a lot of problems with the foreign quota. I'm sure Mr. Mkhitaryan will be pushing the J-League to kind of open that up so they can have 11 foreign players on the pitch. But, it's very interesting. I think they've got a good chance of winning the Emperor's Cup. S-Pulse in the semi-final, I think you'd have to have Kobe as favourites for that. And Kashima are the likely opponents in that final. And they're kind of the last two seasons have taken their toll on Kashima, so I think they could be there for the taking in that game. So that would be very interesting for the league if Kobe are in the Champions League next year, just to see how in the world they approach that.
Yeah, that would be absolutely fascinating. And as you say, Sam, they're only two games away from us finding that out as a reality. All right, well, Sean, the last team we're going to review in the last episode of the 2019 season is the team that finished last. So do you have any last words for Iwata before they shunted back down to J2?
I think what they did was they messed up. I just kind of touched upon it with Reds. I don't think Reds obviously are going to do as badly as Iwata did next season. But I think what they didn't do, they should have got rid of Nanami, or he should have stepped down at the end of last season when things went so badly. He didn't. Wait, have I got that right? He didn't step down, did he? Again, it's been a long year. He stayed on, didn't he? And then he was canned throughout, or he'd stepped down throughout the season, yeah. And, yeah, they had that chance. They had that chance to see it as a warning and go, look, you know, things haven't worked out. Either he could have said, look, I don't want, you know, obviously it was the club he played at, and he has a long history there. He could have said, look, I don't think I'm cut out for this job. Let someone else come in. Or they should have done so themselves, and then they could have maybe stood more of a chance. But I think, you know, the atmosphere didn't change. They got off to a terrible start. Then they changed coach twice throughout the season. Yeah, they did, didn't they? He's changed coach twice. That's why I wasn't sure if he actually had left at the end of last season or not. It's been a long year. And I think that got them off on the wrong foot. And then you've got to really try to change the mood and to get things rolling. They did make a kind of mini revival over the last sort of 2, 3, 4 games, but it was too little too late by then. And, you know, we've seen it before where what you'd call, I guess you'd call sort of big clubs, bigger clubs, you know, the sort of established clubs, the ones who've been around since the J League started, have dropped down, and they've used that opportunity well to refresh, to sort things out. Obviously in recent years, you could maybe say that hasn't worked. Omiya, Albirex, Niigata, Vivara, and Nagasaki. Well, okay, Nagasaki are only up for 1 year, but the teams that do drop down are increasingly struggling to make their way back up. On account of the fact that the second division is getting stronger, and as I touched upon before, there isn't as much of a gap between J1 and J2 as perhaps there used to be. So they didn't take the opportunity after last season's struggles to refresh, and hopefully now they can sort themselves out, maybe get rid of some of the deadwood they've got in the squad. Allow a couple of their talented young players, because they seem to have a couple there that have got some potential, give them a chance to play regularly in J2 next, and yeah, see if they can get back up and then kick on from there.
Indeed. So, one of the biggest names in J-League history, of course, Iwata, but yeah, back down now for a second stint in the second tier. All right, guys, well, that has been absolutely terrific. Thank you ever so much for your time again this week as we wrap up the 2019 J1 season. So we will leave it there. Sam, thanks for all of your input throughout the season. It's been absolutely terrific, and look forward to hooking up again in 2020.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me for all season long, and congratulations again on the milestone. I look forward to listening to episode 301 next season.
Thank you very much, Sam. And Sean, always great to catch up with you. Very much appreciated, as always. And, same thing with Sam. I look forward to doing it again next season once it all gets going again.
Yep, absolutely. Echo what Sam said. Great effort with getting this done every week. It really is a crucial resource for everyone who's interested in the J-League, and you do a fantastic job getting it done, so well done, and hope you can get over Tokyo's disappointing end to the season and have a bit of a break over the off-season before we get up and running again in, well, only be a couple of months, and we'll be at it again.
Indeed, no rest for the wicked, Sean. And I tried to keep the Tokyo content to a minimum on this week's episode, having to go through the pain of it all over again. But that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sam Robson, Sean Carroll, and Stuart Woodward. And, of course, to you for listening wherever you are on the occasion of our 300th episode. It's been a terrific 2019 at J-Talk Towers, and we owe a lot of it to our supporters on Patreon, who have enabled us to carry on without data restrictions and, of course, launch Extra Time with Stuart Smith and John Steele. Thanks to all of them for their support. It is very much appreciated. So that's it for the 2019 J1 season. We may be back to round up the closing stages of the Emperor's Cup, with the semi-finals, of course, on the 21st, and then the final on New Year's Day. Or if not, we will return early in 2020 to look ahead to the new season. Speak to you again soon. Bye for now. Oh, no, he's dropped out again. No. Oh.
Couldn't bring himself to praise you.
Oh, my good. Am I back?
Oh, you're back, yes.
I've been twiddling again now.
I thought he'd managed to wriggle away from the gun you had held against his head there.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.